Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Last year's 9/11 attacks brought into sharp focus how religious differences may be used to justify the most horrific of acts. This issue is certainly not new, and again raises the question of whether such violent intolerance grows out of the religion itself or a misapplication of said religion. Recently, the Society for Middle Eastern Studies sought to address that question with a panel of four distinguished speakers, followed by questions from the audience. Tonight, we present excerpts from the remarks of two of those speakers, Professor Adam Seligman of the Division of Religion and Theological Studies, and Professor Kamar Ul-Huda of the Boston College School of Theology. Next week, we will hear from Professor Abdel Rahman Mohamed, formerly of the College of Communication, and Professor John Clayton of Boston University. Now, here is Adam Seligman speaking on toleration and tradition.
The title of this conversation is Examining Religious Violence. The subtitle is A Panel on Tolerance and Intolerance in the Monotheistic Religions. I won't talk about religious violence. I will talk somewhat about tolerance and intolerance in general, and then have some remarks by way of conclusion about one monotheistic religion, which is Judaism, and about which I do not presume any expertise. I'd like to begin by presenting the somewhat counterintuitive notion that tolerance, or at least a principled tolerance, that is, one not rooted in simple power differentials and the inability to impose one's will on another, that such a tolerance is not at all a modern virtue. Clearly, the dictates of realpolitik may make us tolerant in the absence of alternatives, and that would be true of any society, true in modern as well as in pre-modern times. We know, too, that tolerance, at least within the canon law of the West, was no more than the second best solution, and it was used as it was used to define the position of Jews and prostitutes within society. It defined a status where one had to suffer, toler, sofrir, where one had to suffer an evil. For extirpating either Jews or prostitutes would have had consequences more severe for Western Christendom than suffering their presence, or at least so the redactors of canon law believed. We know, too, that pre-modern societies were often not particularly tolerant ones, and marginal and minority groups, groups who were not part of the regnant definitions of community, were often persecuted and subjugated to no small degree of violence. The degree and nature of violence was different in different places, and here is not the place to compare Islamic and Christian or Western and Eastern Christianity as civilizational forms in terms of their violence, tolerance, and/or acceptance of the other. Such an exercise often turns polemic in nature, and the quite sensible historical comparison often becomes a political-moral jousting match. I have no desire to enter into such a match. What we can learn from all pre-modern societies, however, is that tolerance is very much about groups and group identities. Recall Jews and prostitutes. Tolerance as understood and as practiced, even as not practiced, was a matter of attitudes and behaviors towards corporate groups, and so towards individuals as members of those groups, rather than towards individuals in their unique individuality. Now, given the terms of membership and identity in pre-modern and in religiously organized societies, this, of course, is not at all surprising. Recall that rights were in this world not anything accorded to individuals, but indeed to corporate groups. Such was medieval law and society, and it is only sensible that so too were the terms of tolerance in these societies. There's nothing new here. But it should give us pause for thought. For what I want to claim is that tolerance, and intolerance for that matter, does inherently have to do with groups and with individuals as existing within groups, rather than with individuals as autonomous, self-regulating moral agents endowed with individual rights and acting as such on the public stage. My point will thus not be that pre-modern societies were more tolerant than modern societies or less tolerant in any quantitative sense, but rather that their form of social organization was one that made the whole problem of tolerance relevant. Modern societies, I will be claiming, have elided the whole problem of tolerance rather than solved it. Now, where this works, fine. Where it doesn't, however, one cannot simply add modernity to this mix like salt in a vegetable soup. Moreover, and this is perhaps a good deal more to the point, modern identities are themselves changing, and the type of individual selves which we saw as the necessary concomitant to the nation state are also changing, as is the nation state itself. Subnational and transnational identities are growing apace. Religious, ethnic, and ethno-religious identities are making new claims on the individual sense of self and society. And given these developments, the quintessentially modern moves of individual rights, the quintessentially modern moves that obviated the problem of tolerance and intolerance no longer quite hold. For these reasons, we must mine other sources and perspectives, which is something we'll be talking about this evening. But before anything else, I'd like to work out a bit the analytic aspects of my claim. First, I think it is important to point out that tolerance is a very circumscribed virtue. It is not the solution to all evils. It is not a panacea, nor is it without boundaries. Clearly, some types of behavior are intolerable, though it is not so clear how one would go about defining what or everything that is beyond that pale. It's true, certain religious and philosophical categories come to mind, ideas of natural law, or in the Jewish context, perhaps, the Noahide commandments present some useful general orientation. However, within these limits, there is certainly a great room for disagreement, for disgust, for rejection of much of what considers to be wrong, misguided, immoral, reprehensible, and hence for the need to tolerate what one believes to be wrong and that which makes one uncomfortable. Now, there's no doubt that we can't expect people to tolerate a clearly defined threat to who one is, to one's identity. When that threat is directed at one from the outside, let us say through the barrel of a rifle, one cannot be tolerant. So a clearly defined threat, perhaps, need not be tolerated. But what, we may ask, if that threat, or what is considered a threat, comes from a different direction? Let us say we are all members of the West Roxbury Numismatic Association. Having met for decades, discussing, analyzing, and trading coins, and all of a sudden, a few of our members begin to bring in stamps, refuse even to look at a coin, and proceed to take up meeting space and time with matters philatelic. Must we tolerate them? Do they not equally present a threat to who we are, the West Roxbury Numismatic Society? For sure, we don't have to physically exterminate our budding stamp collectors. Perhaps only politely tell them to leave and join the West Roxbury Philatelic Society that meets down the street. We may tolerate their existence in the greater Boston area, but not as part of our identity, not as part of who we are. Now, the relatively simple point I'm trying to make with this example is that groups have boundaries. Groups cannot exist without boundaries. One cannot make claims to any type of identity without that identity being defined, which in some sense involves it being bounded and circumscribed as well. To ask a group to tolerate what threatens that identity is to ask the group to dismantle itself, to make itself cease to be. And if anything is a model of intolerance, it would be this eradication of existence. Tolerance, then, I'm claiming, is a virtue that has everything to do with boundaries and with margins. It doesn't have to do with all-out threats to who we are, whether that threat comes from the outside or from the inside, whether those threats are physical or symbolic in nature. Rather, tolerance has to do with behaviors and beliefs that exist on the margin of a group's identity. Again, we may think of Jews and prostitutes in medieval canon law as representing good examples of precisely this type of marginality, along with lepers, sometimes Muslims, beggars, strangers, and so on. All existed on the borders or margins of society, not beyond, not totally beyond, and of course not fully within. Now, if you'll bear with me and follow this logic to its conclusion, you'll reach an interesting point, which is, of course, that the thicker the boundaries, or the wider, whichever metaphor works best for you, the thicker the boundaries of identity, the greater the number of individuals, behaviors, attitudes will reside on that boundary. The thinner the boundary, the fewer. Hence, the thicker the boundary, the more issues of tolerance and intolerance are raised and become relevant, as the greater chances one will come into contact with behaviors and beliefs that one finds objectionable, without them necessarily threatening one's identity, though perhaps causing one to make endless calculations as to the existence or non-existence of precisely such a threat. And of course, it is once again clear why tolerance was such an important theme in societies with strong group identities, because these are societies with very thick boundaries, with very wide corporate identities and group definitions, which necessitate such tolerance, however often and tragically they may have been defined by its actual failure or absence. Now, my point here is that modern societies, societies defined, let us say, by the Déclaration des droits de l'homme citoyen or by the American Constitution, do not so much make societies more tolerant, rather, they do away with group boundaries. I think it is best summed up by Count Stanislav de Clermont-Tonnerre in his famous 1789 speech to the National Assembly in Paris, where he said famously, "We must refuse everything to the Jews as a nation and accord everything to the Jews as individuals." In a sense, this has been the project of modern states, in their liberal form even more than in other more romantic national forms. It refers not simply to Jews, but to every corporate group, and certainly to those who consider themselves truth communities. For within the public sphere, boundaries are passed into razor-thin edges, and individuals interact not as members of groups, but as bearers of rights, citizen rights, social rights, human rights, consumer rights, and so on. Group identities have been, in the public sphere, replaced by individual identities, and the problem of tolerance, that is, the problem of difference, has been replaced by the legal recognition and entitlements of rights. This is what I mean when I say that modernity has elided the problem of tolerance, obviated the necessity to be tolerant, rather than actually make people tolerant. It has replaced tolerance with rights. Critically, this development has more than political dimensions. It is also the basis of social and economic life in most Western liberal societies and is, in fact, of course, a critical aspect of globalization. And this is the difference between what Ernest Gellner once termed multi-stranded and single-stranded relationships. In the first, multi-stranded, and I quote Gellner here, a man buying something from a village neighbor in a tribal community is dealing not only with a seller, but also with a kinsman, collaborator, ally or rival, potential supplier of a bride for his son, fellow juryman, ritual participant, fellow defender of the village, fellow councilman, and so on. This situation, of course, is very different from the single-stranded relations we enter into when purchasing a commodity, wherein our calculations are on the whole oriented around purchasing the best possible commodity for the least possible price. And this difference in social relations has a huge implication for matters of tolerance. Let me illustrate with a very small example. My relations with my car mechanic are single-stranded. He fixes the catalytic converter, and I pay him a few $100. That is all there is to the relationship. When he has completed his job and I have paid him, the relationship is over. There is nothing left, as it were. We need not be tolerant of one another, and our interaction before, during, and after is controlled solely by matters of legal rights, rights to property, equality access to market resources, exchange, and so on. Clear, yeah? My relationship with my acupuncturist, however, is somewhat different. She is a member of my synagogue. I see her every Saturday. A number of times in the past, I came to their home at very odd hours of the morning at night to help her husband fulfill religious obligations when his father died. They did the same for us. They have been to our house for dinner. I give references to her son, a student of religion at Columbia University. She gives us all a discount on the acupuncture. In some cases, my wife gives her yoga lessons rather than cash payments. In short, our relationship is complex, multi-stranded, and with very broad boundaries. And if, let us say, her son was not a wonderful, pleasant, and bright young man, but a rather foul-mouthed and insensitive lout, well, I would still have to tolerate his presence at my dinner table, because my relationship to his family is made up of thick stuff rather than the single-stranded acts of exchange guaranteed by legal rights. Tolerance, I would like to claim, is all about relations that exist on these thick boundary lines of identity. Identity that must, by definition, be a group identity of sorts. Much of the economic and political thrust of the modern world order is, however, about replacing group identities with individual ones, replacing tolerance with rights, and replacing a relatively small number of multi-stranded relationships with an almost infinite number of single-stranded ones. In the process, tolerance goes from being a community-centered act to an individual, almost psychological attribute or personal characteristic. As I intimated earlier, I do not think there is anything wrong, you know, morally wrong, with solving the problem of intolerance by removing the social conditions that make tolerance necessary. Quite the contrary, it's a very good job if you can get it. My feeling, however, is that those conditions which defined the high modernity of Western European and the North Atlantic nation state are currently changing. A return to group-based identities of sorts and to religious commitments in many parts of the world, the growth of transnational identities predicated on religion, ethnicity, and nationhood not dependent on statehood, all these are calling into question the types of individual identities that stood at the core of the revolution, the 18th century revolutionary idea of citizenship. This globalization of economic relations has not, however, led to a restructuring of collective ideology along the lines, say, of mid-18th century Glasgow or end of 18th century Boston. To the extent that this is the case, we will have to reinvent a language of tolerance not predicated on liberal and modernist ideas of the self and of the interaction between selves. To do so, we will, I believe, need have recourse to other foundations, and I believe to religious foundations for tolerance. Arguments rooted, in a sense, in the foundational texts of the three Abrahamic religions, all of whom recognize this problem of difference, this problem of otherhood, all of whom do not attempt to define it away, but with greater or lesser skill, meet the problem of tolerance and of difference head on. Allow me, please, to present one or two examples from Judaism. When coming to explore Judaism's attitude towards other religions, it is important first to recall that Judaism is not a universalistic religion, at least not in the same sense that Christianity and Islam are universalistic. Judaism does not proclaim a truth for all mankind, but only for Jews. It does not make the same religious demands of all peoples and does not posit the same relationship to God of all peoples. While this, what has been called the tribal nature of Judaism, and has often been used to attack and to denigrate Judaism, right? The trope of the proud Pharisee and of the arrogant Jew is one we're all familiar with over 2,000 years of Christian culture. It's a very familiar part of Western European anti-Semitic discourse. But this very tribal or particularistic nature has also rather different and less noted aspects. For one important derivative of Judaism's very particularism is that it does not present a homogeneous, undifferentiated, or totalistic vision of the good. If we understand the religious vision of the good as more or less analogous to its vision of salvation, we are left with a message very relevant to this day and age. For Judaism's vision of the end of days does not at all posit the conversion of everyone to Judaism and the acceptance by all peoples of the world of all 613 commandments that obligate the life of the religious Jew. Rather, as we know in the prophets, the vision of the end of days is the recognition by all of the unity of God together with the maintenance of their own practices and identities. Not the homogenization of differences, but their continuity is one very powerful theme in Jewish visions of the end of days. It's admittedly not the only one. I note this at the beginning of my short talk on Judaism, for I think that any understanding of Judaism's attitude towards the other must begin with our realization that Judaism, as a particular religious culture, recognizes the continued existence of other particular cultures. It accepts their existence of other religions and does not demand their elimination, even in its vision of messianic times. This is not Galatians, there is neither Jew nor Christian nor Greek, nor servant nor bondsman nor freeman, but all one in Christ Jesus. It's a very, very different vision. Having said this, it is just as important to recall that while Judaism accepts the existence of other religions, it is somewhat ambivalent about their legitimacy. In a manner similar to Islam, Judaism withholds legitimacy from pagan rites and practices of chairs of departments and so on, and is unsparing in its rejection of their legitimacy. A whole tractate of the Talmud is dedicated to the rules regulating the contact of Jews in proximity to pagan practices. Yet, here too, the situation is more complicated than would appear at first sight, because within the corpus of Jewish law, there exists something called the Noahide commandments, the laws presumably given by God to the children of Noah after the flood. In other words, before they were Jews. These are generally taken to be the following: prohibitions on blasphemy, idolatry, sexual immorality, murder, robbery, the prohibition to eat the flesh of a living animal, all prohibitions, and one positive commandment of great importance, the obligation to establish courts of law. Peoples that accept these obligations are granted full legitimacy within the Jewish tradition, and indeed are granted the highest marker of that such legitimacy, they're granted a place in the world to come. While clearly not condoning paganism, such an idea as a sort of minimalist universal, akin perhaps to natural law, is a major source of orientations towards the other within Judaism. Moreover, and of great significance, is the type of move made in the 13th century by philosophers such as Rabbi Menachem Ha'Meiri of Provence, who saw such legislation as pertaining not simply to individuals, who lived in accordance with the Noahide law, but who saw them as pertaining to whole societies, what he termed nations who were defined by religious obligations. That is, who accepted the Noahide laws and led an organized social life predicated on the existence of legal rules, courts, and a political rule of law. In the thought of Ha'Meiri, then, whole social systems of non-Jews were granted legitimacy and not solely the acts of righteous individuals. There are additional moves in this direction of substantive recognition of the other within Judaism, not predicated solely on Noahide commandments. The uncovering of these traditions and the attempts to move them to center stage within an internal Jewish discourse has been done by people I work with in some of the projects. One important and interesting strand of this argument was that developed within Jewish medieval philosophy, which stressed, within Jewish legal thought, which stressed the universality of reason and of the rules of reason, and hence, in a sense, of a natural morality that preceded the obligations of the Torah, Thus, we could draw attention to certain elements that haven't always been emphasized within the tradition. I'll give you an example, quoting very briefly from Yehuda Halevi's Sefer HaKuzari, the Book of the Kuzari, written in the 12th century, who stated, and I quote, that the rational laws are the basis and preamble of divine law, preceding it in character and time, and being indispensable in the administration of every human society. Second book, paragraph 48. We should note that while Halevi was greatly influenced by the great Islamic philosopher Al-Ghazali, the quote that I just read deals less with the supremacy of revelation and more with the existence of reason as independent of revelation, and so by implication the legitimacy of alternative forms of social life defined by natural law and natural reason, and not solely by revelation. We see here, as we can find in other texts, including Nachmanides' commentary on Deuteronomy, we see here a recognition of alternative non-Judaic sources of law and morality. Now, clearly, there is not simply one Judaism any more than there's one Islam or one Christianity or one secular modernity, for that matter. Traditions, including religious traditions, are not and have never been of one piece. They are rather discordant voices sharing a common language, but with very, very different resonances, dialects, and expressive fields. Clearly, too, the particular historical, social, political, and international situation at any one time will seriously affect the type of voices which will attain primacy at one time rather than the other. This is as true of Judaism as it is of Islam or Christianity. And we all know that one can mine a tradition text for any quote or source to support just about any position one would want to take. That is why, rather than simply bring forth a compendium of sources and quotes, very briefly I try to present here a more abstract argument rooted in an overall or meta-orientation of the religious tradition. It must, of course, also be admitted that for millennia, Judaism was not tested in terms of practical politics, as Jews lacked political power and were not in a position to organize the distribution of resources in society, nor had the responsibility for the promulgation of justice beyond and in a very mediated way the confines of their own community. There were no minorities in the ghetto. Right? The ghetto was the minority within the overall population. The Jews were not responsible for another minority. 50 years ago, this situation changed radically with the establishment of the State of Israel and rule over what is now 20% of the population who are not Jewish, probably more. And it is quite clear that the seduction of power has not left the religious sensibility unscathed. Quite the opposite. Quite the opposite. I'd like to believe that the present crisis is, however, also an opportunity, one where boundaries may be redrawn, redrawn, interpretive traditions reassessed, and the dictates of religious obligations opened to new understandings. Thank you very much.
Professor Adam Seligman speaking on Toleration and Tradition. You're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Our second speaker tonight is a professor at the School of Theology at Boston College, Kamar Ul-Huda. Professor Huda speaks on reassessing violence in Islamic thought. Professor Huda.
How busy I've been since the September 11th attacks. Not busy in the way that perhaps one would imagine in giving discussions or talks and running around, but busy up in mind and busy inside. Busy inside thinking about not only particular reasons and how this led to what happened, but really busy in transcending and thinking about some of my own experiences overseas, particularly in madrasas when I was studying in seminaries in Egypt and Pakistan and South Asia. And coming across other students, probably half my age, very, very strict on their interpretation of Islam, their interpretation of the text, and their understanding of the law. And so I've been busy this past year and a half, even more, on trying to make sense on some of the realistic and pragmatic answers that are given within the Islamic world. And when is war feasible, permissible? When is conflict understandable? And when does pursue conflict resolution? What I'd like to do in the next few minutes is present some of the major ideas about war and conflict in Islam, and then give my own perspective. It's a work in progress on issues that I think the Islamic community needs to deal with on issues of violence and toleration and reconciliation. One of the things that many of you probably do know, or the number of prayers a Muslim, a devout, pious Muslim would pray about five times a day, the things they repeat, Adnas Sirat al-Mustaqim, keep me on the straight path. If this pious Muslim recites this particular surah, this chapter from the Quran, the number of times requested, keep me on the straight path, the path that doesn't anger you, that's repeated about 60 times a day. The siratul, the word siratul, the path, is found over two dozen places in the Quran. This sense, that path, there is a real path, a real path that guides, and in that path, you are the vanguard of keeping harmony and a divine order. So when speaking about a violence or conflict in Islam, that cannot be discussed before you understand or discuss what is peace or the absence of peace. And so my point in that, if you miss over the next 2 minutes, is that the concepts of war in Islam, the classical rules of war, the classical theories on war, came about in absence of peace. It came about in a time of expansionary policies of the first dynasty, the Umayyad dynasty. It came about of the need to have real policy institutionalized very quickly. It came about at a time when law needed to be institutionalized and executed very quickly. And many of the policies and understandings of war came about when this peace was absent. Many of those ideas and examples came from the sections of the Quran, came from the lives of the prophet, came from the memory of the prophet's companions, came from all of these various literature surrounding the prophet, and of course this big volume of literature surrounding legal exegesis. One of the things that three points that come about in times of peace, and what some of those theories are, that there is a sense of first human responsibility in ushering this a sense of accountability of obeying the law, obeying authority, obeying revelation being preserved in the state. That your knowledge, if once you pursue knowledge and for insight, for self-understanding, for keeping a divine order, quote unquote, is to promote harmony within humanity. That is, this is not tribally or religiously defined. It's not defined for Muslims, it's not defined for Jews, it's not defined for any ethnic or religious group. That the primary idea theologically is responsibility during time of peace. The second idea within peacetime is that one should be thoughtful and conscious of the idea of judgment and accountability, that if one moves away from peace and towards conflict, one has to think about how that the whole process of conflict is to return to harmony. That war or conflict is just a moment in time to return to the harmony that was lost. Okay? That what happened was a neglect of our responsibility, a neglect of our sense of duty. What happened was a forgetfulness of being conscious of maintaining harmony. And the third main variable that came up during this time, the classical period, is that political institutions are obligated, that is the state, the political institutions are obligated in ensuring peace and harmony. They are the ones who are endowed to make sure that if society moves away from peace and a chaos world, chaotic world, that it is their obligation to have a policy to return to that. And so they are given this obligation to make sure that persons and institutions reflect that movement from harmony to chaos to back to harmony. Now, one of the things, those are the three main concepts in the classical period of the 8th and 9th centuries. One of the things they did during this time of severe expansionary and defending borders and defining identity, the need for a real policy on war, was to really bring about rules and conduct of war. Okay, one of the major thinkers of the 9th century, al-Shabani, wrote a book on the Book of the Way. And this scholar particularly was interested in who must fight, when one can one fight, against whom is this permissible, what means is used, what does it mean for military success, how are the parameters defined when one fights. So essentially, this particular theorist was defining those parameters based on the Quran, the memory of the Prophet, and the literature surrounding the Prophet and the companions. And let me give you, I won't give you, I mean, the book is about three volumes. I'll just give you some cliff notes of what they, some of those examples. For example, one of the things he said is that the state is the only authorized institution in Islam to permit any war. That is, unless the state doesn't declare a war, there can't be a war. They can only declare a war on two assumptions, which is if they were attacked, if a state is attacked, a territory is attacked, then that state has the right to declare war immediately or soon. But the only other way to a state to declare war is the consultation. The state and its politicians must have consultation with the ulama, the religious scholars. Okay? This is just the basics that he starts off with in this first page. Then he moves on in another chapter, who must fight? And he makes it very clear based on hadith and sunnah, the customs of the Prophet, and based on historical memory or situations. So those who can only fight in Islam are those who are trained as soldiers and combatants. One person can't just get up in the morning, brush their teeth, and say, okay, now I'm going to war. The person who is trained as a soldier can only then fight. Okay? That means militias can't just join in a war. Guerrillas who are joining in can't just join in the war. People who want to volunteer overnight and just want to jump in the battlefield can't join in the war, must have proper training. And then specifically, who do you fight? Combatants only must fight other combatants. If you do find yourself in a war and you are a soldier trained and there is a declared war, the only way persons you can fight are other soldiers of the other side who've been declared enemies. Okay? Clearly, the rules and context and the hows and when and whys go on and on and on. But this, the rules of when to fight and how to fight are very laid down pretty clearly. So you can't fight non-combatants, you can't fight innocent victims, you can't fight civilians, you can only fight particular soldiers of the other side. The other thing is, and this is a footnote to a soldier can only be a soldier in Islam, at least the Sunni classical perspective, is only if this person has, in a sense, got a permission slip from your mother, for lack of a better term. That means you can't abandon your obligations of being a family person, a head of a household, your civic duties in the community. Only if you don't have any of those things, then you can become a soldier. Okay? And my last point, and then there are many other rules and conditions and subconditions and categories, but one of the things I thought would be interesting, because it will take me to my other point, which is when you fight, what you can hurt and you can't destroy. And you can't destroy ecology, you can't destroy the environment, you can't destroy the drinking water, the water system, or the plants and trees and so forth. All of these things you must have heard of in the past year. So this brings us a big question. How does this really explain with modern fundamentalist radical movements? So how does this explain some of those things? But I did want to say that the 9th century, early 9th century and late 9th century, really made and defined the rules of war in Islam developed in a climate when there was war. Theories on war came not in a vacuum, but when there was war. And even when theorists talked about war in the 12th century, in the 15th century, when there was peace, that influenced their ideas of war. Okay. For instance, Averroes, commonly called Ibn Rushd, spoke about a war and conflict later when he was in Spain. And one of the things he spoke about was, of course, doing one of the second or third crusades. He spoke about, well, if one has to pursue war, the problem with war, that it destroys all of the love of life. And one of the things he talked about is, he said, if war is necessary, then it must not destroy, if you're going to engage in war, it must not destroy three things. And he talks about life, property, and liberty. That he was talking in kind of an esoteric war, very much like a lot of other his writings, which is, there should be a kind of a non-physical war. It shouldn't take people's lives, it shouldn't take their property, and it shouldn't take away their liberty. Of all the three things, are the most important things. So these classical and neoclassical theories on war, I wanted to point out, not only defined their particular moment and reflects their moment in Islam, of their connection to the state, their connection to expansionary policies, or the connection of the desire to move towards a more harmonious world. What does this lead us to do and think? How does this play out in the modern world? And I mean to go back and forth on purpose, which is, how do Muslims, knowing that the very basics of war and the rules of war in Islam are being violated in, let's say, the 10-year war between Iran and Iraq, the war between Muslims, which is clearly a very famous saying of the Prophet, that you are your brother, don't you take any other lives, you are one community. And how do they justify that? How did Khomeini justify the hostages, taking of the hostages for over 1 year? How do suicide bombers justify committing suicide and taking innocent lives, civilians? And so forth. How did these hijackers justify themselves in doing some of that? Now, in answering all of this, I could give you an answer within the religious prism, the legal prism, But I want to keep in mind that that's not probably the only prism possible. That many of these people are probably not even acting or thinking in those terms. That's not even their concern. Okay? And this is one of the issues in the modern period, which is in the creation of various states, the centralization of certain power, the kind of ineffectiveness of certain religious class, the ulama, you have the power being concentrated in one short, small group of hands. And for Muslim groups, activist groups, military groups, and political groups, what is very important is their perception of war, their perception of siege. And if you can perceive that you are under attack, then they take the first element that I pointed out, that they can declare war, because the state is ineffective. Remember, I said in the beginning that only a state can declare a war, and only a state can declare a war with the consultation with the ulama. But if these religious groups, specifically Hamas, Hezbollah, and then the Taliban and Qaeda and so forth, these specific groups, when they purposely say that these states are ineffective, that they're, in a sense, they're puppets to secularism, they're puppets to the West, and they're puppets to everything else, that they're bringing their own sense, and they are themselves the reasons for this war, that then you have this change of the paradigm. The classical rules and guidelines of war are no longer part of the equation. And that's one of the issues and problems. That if your perception of war is now the state, or these individuals, or whoever you want to substitute, then that means anyone can step up to the plate and declare themselves as the new authority. And that's where Osama bin Laden he thought he can give a fatwa, a briefing on saying this is a time for war. And that's why you find anyone within these various groups, whether these radical groups or even states declaring a time for war on other groups like Saddam Hussein, that they have neglected the historical context of war, the classical theories of war, and created new ones with new paradigms. So one of the other reasons, and I want to conclude so our last speaker will have a chance to give more specific examples, is that the changes in modern state and the modern relationships with the centralized power in one few hands, you have a change in perceptions within many Muslim groups thinking that this allows them to change at the rules and the new rules of war. And we have many modern thinkers like Tabat Tabai and Sheikh Mahmoud Abdu who said that, who spoke against these type of changes. The other thing I'd like to just point out before I leave and give a chance, and I also have a discussion, is that one of the things that's missing in pre-modern thought and modern thought on war and violence in Islam is the absence of many other components of war and conflict, such as if you view violence as physical harm or you view violence as absence of peace, we ignore many other important and not so subtle forms of violence, that is domestic violence, verbal violence, gender, class violence, labor violence, capital punishment, tribal violence, ethnic violence, and so on. We ignore all of these things, and I think one of the things that are facing the Islamic world is how to reconcile these various dimensions of violence, given the new dimensions of the state, the different ineffectiveness of the state, inability to cope with its own groups, its own power. But internally, I think there has to be a serious dialogue on reconciliation of violence, reconciliation of past and modern theories of war. And what that means, I think, perhaps, is a greater effort in understanding the past and its proper context, its proper historical context, and creating a new hermeneutics of the faith where there is a greater emphasis on awareness and deeper meaning of faith and its obligation for maintaining a harmonious society. Thank you. My response is to when Muslim radical groups attack others, innocent civilians, whether they be Muslims or Christians or Jews, It goes back to my theory that they perceive these people, these civilians, other civilians, as obstacles to their agenda, and they are tied to the war, that they are collaborating with and with sources that are considered to be enemies of their particular ideology or particular agenda. So, for instance, when a person in Hamas kills other Palestinians, or someone in Pakistan kills other people and Muslims in the same group or a rival group, it has nothing to do with some of the legal history or some of the religious principles that should be guiding that particular society, but it goes with the short-term poor vision of particular political goals, and it's not grounded in text. As for minorities in Islam, I think there are groups that are around, the human rights groups in each and every country. Whether they get their voices are heard or not heard is another issue. The equality is not the same perspective as we understand it to be today. I mean, it's been a changing idea even in the last 50, 60 years in our own society, what is equality. So it's hard to use that particular word within another tradition and culture and time and space. But I would definitely say that from the very beginning of 7th century, there were particular institutions set up to protect, and even in the Quran, to protect non-Muslims, particularly Jews and Christians, but people of the book. And historically, other places and other regions, like under the Mughal Empire, Hindus and Buddhists were considered people of the book. And there was it's been a changing and evolving idea, even though theologically it was hard to prove. In the modern world, is it possible? Are they being protected? I think they're having the same problems with other Muslim groups, whether it be minorities or Muslims. If they're in the particular way of that modern radical political group, they're going to pay and suffer for that.
Professor Kamar Al-Huda on Reassessing Violence in Islamic Thought. Next week, we conclude this two-part series, Examining Religious Violence, with Professors Abdul Rahman Mohammed and John Clayton. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15 and include shipping and handling. To learn more about Boston University's World of Ideas, visit our website at buwi.org. Tonight's program was produced by Keith Infantino, with help from John Hoder, Vince Fairchild, and Andy Farnsworth. Our web producer is Angel Cozzelli. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for being with us.